This is Lynn Benton Tractor's Newsmakers with Brent DeHart and Dave Bourne, presented by Les Schwab Tires and sponsored in part by Furbish, a salvage place, and Kennedy Tax Solutions. Live, local talk that matters to you. Now, here's Brent and Dave from the Capital Auto Group Studios, exclusively on 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.
Hello and welcome to Newsmakers. This is Brent DeHart. Thank you for joining us in this fabulous day to live in the Mid-Willamette Valley.
Every day is a great day.
It is. Thank you. And hey, thanks for joining us to talk radio. This is where we talk about local initiatives and ideas and institutions and individuals. And we've got a couple of those things to talk about today.
Absolutely.
It's going to be a great hour. So thanks for joining us for your lunch hour. Let's get right to it because we've got a guest here in the studio. And I know you're all tired of listening to me talk after yesterday. So, and this is a subject that I find fascinating and actually intersects with so many different things in our society, right?
Yes.
I know that you're going through the process of buying a new home.
I
just got through the process of building a new home. One of the discussions in American culture right now is continues to be materialism, belongings. The whole new generation of people to find that they don't really want to be tied down to
a big
massive
house.
Mortgages, yeah. Massive belongings, sets of belongings, and things like that. This intersects with a lot of things, including regulation that happens in America and, of course, just our overall culture and what we value. And
go big or go small.
Whether or not it's some things or a gain or loss. All right, Renee McLaughlin, welcome to the studio.
Thank you.
So we've got Renee here, and Renee is the CEO of Tiny Fest. Tiny Fest.
Yes.
So we celebrate all things little.
Right. So you have go big, you have go small, and you have go tiny.
Go
wow.
Tiny.
Okay.
One more option.
And we're
in
talking
life.
About tiny home options, right?
Yes.
And how big is this wave in America?
Well, the tiny wave is definitely growing. We're seeing more and more tiny house builders.
I hope tiny doesn't get huge.
Well, you know, how big would tiny be if it were huge? That's
not
a
tiny.
That's like a
normal
puzzle in the brain.
Yeah. All right. So we actually, my wife and I looked at tiny homes as an option a year or so ago. Did not opt to pick it, but we could definitely see the traction.
Absolutely. And as we talked about for a moment, tiny houses aren't for everyone. I think one of the major factors for you was your dogs. Mm-hmm. I do know people that have tiny houses and have large dogs, but it's a choice. But it's a choice I think we should all have to be able to make. And I'm glad that it's an option now more for people. And I'm glad that the acceptance is growing so that more people can choose this if that's what they'd like to do.
All right. Well, let's define this for the listener. What is tiny living?
So most people will define tiny houses as a structure that's between 100 and 400 square feet. So
okay.
Personally,
so 400 square feet, folks, that's a 20 by 20 room if you want to visualize that.
Like
right?
A,
some people
like
have master
studio,
bedrooms that
yeah,
big, right?
A studio apartment.
Right.
All right, yeah. So 100 to 400 square feet.
Yeah, so personally, my home is 87 square feet. So I was at an event this weekend under one of those standard 10 by 10 tents, mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. I said, my house is smaller than this.
What?
How could that be?
Yeah, right? And I have a kitchen area, a bathroom, a closet, a bed, a small desk.
You don't have to sleep standing up.
I don't, which is really good.
She hangs from the ceiling instead.
Is it mobile?
It is mobile, and that is a big benefit for me. I really enjoy visiting different places and meeting different people and experiencing different areas of the country. And so with my job having three tiny house festivals, one in the Midwest, one in the Northwest, and one in California, it does help me to be able to, you know, feel at home and be at home everywhere that I go, rather than trying to hop around to a hotel room or finding a short-term rental or crashing with another friend, you know.
You just pack your whole house with you.
Right.
Yes,
and
yes.
You don't have to worry about packing.
It's better right? than camping.
It's fabulous. Yeah, you don't have to worry about what you should take with you and what you leave behind.
That is interesting. All right, the classifications of different types of tiny homes. Because obviously, not all of them are mobile.
They aren't. And that's kind of a common misconception. I think most people, when they hear tiny house, they think about or visualize what they've seen on TV, the tiny houses on wheels, mm-hmm. which are generally 8.5 feet wide, because that is the legal width to be able to go down the road. They're generally up to about 13 and a half feet tall because, again, another standard with bridge heights and such. And the length can vary. But there are tiny houses on foundation as well. And again, that's just, you know, just picturing a smaller sized home.
Permanent camping.
Well, no, absolutely. Those tiny houses are they can be very, very nice. I mean, you know, if camping, you're going without, but this home does have, if it's a house that is being placed like as an accessory dwelling unit or on a permanent piece of land, and permanent being, you know, you can have it there for a year or 3 years. You don't have to, you know, commit to a 30-year mortgage. And,
right.
And if your job moves you, you can move with it. But yeah, they have plumbing and electrical and everything you would need, not camping.
We're talking to Renee McLaughlin of Tiny Fest, the CEO. There's an event coming up next weekend, the 17th and 18th, called Tiny Living Festival. And we're going to talk more about it in a little bit. But Tiny Living Festival, it's going to be at Polk County Fairgrounds if you want to head out and check this out. So is this, how would you draw a distinction between what's an RV, what's a motorhome, what's a tiny home that is mobile? I mean, are we going to see all these classifications at your Tiny Fest?
Well, you won't see RVs.
Not RVs.
But you will see the...
Because those are vehicles.
Yeah. So you will see the tiny houses on wheels. We have a shipping container home coming, gypsy wagons, schoolies, which is a school bus conversion.
Uh-huh.
Those are pretty popular with families that choose to travel because they're a little bit bigger. And then you may know someone that has one of the high roof vans or the adventure vans. Mm-hmm. Those are very popular as well. And some really amazing builds that people have done. So shipping container home, I think maybe I mentioned that, but several different types. And
so a shipping container home, you build this home, it's in a shipping container, you just put it on a flatbed and off you go?
Yes. So generally they are a bit heavy to be traveling around with, but they are great to place in a remote property or sometimes in a backyard setting. Often those are referred to as accessory dwelling units or mm-hmm. commonly called ADUs. Those usually have design standards they have to meet that blend in with the other styles of housing in a community. So that would have to be in a little bit more of a modern or industrial type setting to meet those design standards.
Hmm. So Renee, what's a gypsy wagon?
A gypsy wagon is a classic Romani heritage type wagon. They usually have a curved roof or a bow top roof, and it may resemble something you think of as a sheep herder's wagon, or the wagons that the Romani gypsy tribes traveled in.
Wow.
Beautiful.
I think
beautiful.
You said that really, really well. And despite all those descriptions, not one picture came into my head.
I did.
Yeah.
I pictured a truck with a big old camper type of thing on with a rounded roof on the top.
Yeah. Well, actually, if you think more historically, so something that you might see the Romani version of a covered wagon.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So a little bit, you know, not canvas though.
Okay.
And you've got some of that fancy, intricate artwork on the side and
nice.
The beautiful colors.
So, wow. There's a lot to, that's a lot to talk about. When we come back from the break, we're going to talk about who uses these, whether or not they can be used for investment properties and opportunities and so forth, how it runs counter to people's lifestyle in America in terms of how much do we save? How much do we spend as Americans on organizing our stuff?
Right.
Organizing our stuff and storing our stuff. And so many other things. So stick with us. We're going to come right back with Renee McLaughlin of Tiny Fest Living Festival here on Newsmakers on 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.
This is Lynn Benton Tractors Newsmakers with Brent and Dave, presented by Les Schwab Tires and sponsored in part by Furbish, a salvage place, and Kennedy Tax Solutions. Now, let's go back to the Capital Auto Group studios on 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.
This segment of Newsmakers is proudly brought to you by Color Tile of Salem.
Welcome back to the Newsmakers, folks. This is Brent DeHart here with Dave Bourne, and our guest today is Renee McLaughlin. She's the CEO of Tiny Fest, an event coming up next weekend, Tiny Fest Northwest, right, in Polk County Fairgrounds, August 17th and 18th. People can go out and learn about them. You can see samples, I assume.
Oh, absolutely. Tour all different kinds of
homes.
And you're
going to have speakers and people who kind of answer all your questions about
it. Yes.
There's a lot of people who are titillated about this. Sometimes we just get too weighed down in our stuff.
Yes.
We just get too weighed down in what we own and keeping track of it. And especially for many of us who are going through a transition with our parents. And then I've got one set of parents and in-laws, actually, who getting rid of everything.
Getting rid of everything.
She says, I don't want you to have to go through a bunch of junk when I pass. It's like giving away and throwing away almost everything and just living very simply.
It's very freeing, too. It kind of feels good. Not only you're giving things to people, but it really almost feels like taking burden off your shoulder. Like, okay, this is gone.
Every time I buy something, it's just like, I think that's just one more thing. If I have it, it's one more thing to take care of.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so it's one more thing to take care of until we spend our lives so overburdened with stuff. And storage. I mean, how much does America spend on storage and on organizational tools?
I think it's about 1 in 8 Americans has a storage unit.
Wow.
That's a lot. I'm one of them. So
yeah. You must be really organized to be able to live in, 87 square feet?
Right. Yes. I've been accused of being organized before. So it's still something, though, that I go through. Right now, I feel like I have too many clothes. I need to go through and just weed out because, you know, it happens. I see something I like, and just like everyone else, I add to my collection at times. Not anywhere near at the rate, I think, of a lot of other people. But I do. And it's just something that's a constant, you know, go through and see what are you valuing in your life and what do you need in your life. And yeah.
Okay. So we're talking about these tiny ways of living, and some of them are mobile and some of them are not.
Mm-hmm.
How does this intersect with, I mean, a mobile is going to be classified as far as the government's concerned as a towed vehicle, right? Something that you would tow, like a trailer of some sort,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
What about the ones that stay in place? How are local governments and state governments classifying them?
Well, you know, that's one of the things that needs to have some consistency to it. So a lot of places are using that term tiny home or accessory dwelling unit. Oregon has just passed a House resolution to create code for small buildings. Because you just building small is hard to do and meet the ANSI code or the IRC code just because of the space that you need in those codes to create even a bathroom. You know, you have to have so much clearance here and rooms that are a certain size. So states are adopting small building code, which helps. Most states do not allow sleeping in a loft, in a lofted area. So, no matter what size of home you have, it's really not it's not allowed as a sleeping area. Mm. So that has been addressed in, say, the IRC code. There's an Appendix Q, which has been added to the most recent version of the IRC code, and that's been addressed there.
And how is Oregon as far as being on the forefront of this, or are they lagging behind in terms of adjusting regulations?
You know, I think Oregon's really on the forefront, which it makes it difficult because there is some trial and error, right? It's easier to see what has someone else done and copy it, which is great for the rest of the nation because they can see what has happened, what is working, and take that as their base starting point. So, you know, being the first one, you work through some ups and downs, and Oregon's doing a great job of that. I think sometimes people need to give them more credit, you know, they, as far as being that leader is not an easy thing to do.
Well, there is some land use culture here. Mm-hmm. And frankly, they need to do these kinds of things to even be in line with their own culture of making sure that there's no sprawl, making sure we do higher density, making sure we have lower costs to entry for housing. Because, I mean, if I'm going to build a mini home, what kind of range am I talking about in a tiny home compared to a 2,200 square foot house, right?
Right, yeah. If you're going to build it, like you said, you built your house. I imagine that you could build it really well for $25,000 to maybe $35,000, depending on the amenities that you want. If you're going to go with a professional builder, which if you don't have that building experience, it's really important to do that, to have a safe and well-designed home. And those would be generally $60,000 to $80,000 or $85,000. And that's a very good, you know, quality build.
Wow. So, well, that goes back to who designs these things and who builds them? Are there contacts through your organization? And will people learn about that at Tiny Fest Northwest?
Right, exactly. We do have professional show model homes that people come in and tour. They could talk to the professional builders and meet with those folks and see how, you know, how does their design process work and what kind of quality do they have, so they get to see it firsthand. But we also have what we call a tiny dweller village. And this is people that actually live in their tiny house. So it's not a show model. It's something that's currently lived in full time. See, and most of them have built their own. So it's a great perspective to see, you know, some great ideas and what did they learn? What would they do different? You know, how are they finding life on the road or stationary? We have a, kind of all those different aspects represented. And so it's really fun to meet those folks that are bringing their home and showing that off to you.
That would be cool. Maybe we'll learn a few things about how to live without. We did live in a trailer for 10 months and 10 days. Not that I counted.
No.
But it was 10 months and 10 days.
Yeah, right.
And it was a 30-foot trailer. And we really did learn how much we can live without. And it's like, oh, let's not even open these boxes. Let's just make them disappear and we'll just live without them. Right.
Right.
Hey, all right. I want to transition a little bit. For the ones that stay in place, and there's some tiny home communities in this region, then there's some ability. There's one south of town that modeled a little bit to me more like a manufactured home park, mm-hmm. where you don't buy the property, you share the infrastructure and so forth, right? And is that most common, or are people finding lots or using them as an accessory dwelling unit, an ADU on an existing home lot, or all three?
I would say the most common right now is to have them as an accessory dwelling unit. Hmm. And there are a lot of people that would love to live in a community where they do own their own land, or to have the tiny house as their primary home on land that they own. However, the regulations aren't there for that yet. So the accessory dwelling unit is kind of the path that has been open, and that's the path that we're, you know, working with to yet open more and then move on to the next step, which I do think would be great to be able to own a piece of property and put a tiny house on it as the primary residence.
We're talking to Renee McLaughlin. She's the CEO of Tiny Fest. Tiny Fest Northwest is coming up next weekend. You mentioned the shipping containers, mm-hmm. right? And plopping them down on your property. And do you have to be a remote property? Because I just keep thinking of the... You
know, well, she did mention industrial area. I mean, they would blend in, really well
then
there.
But then you run into zoning issues, right? You can't live in an industrial zone. But you did mention remote areas as well.
Right. In places like Texas, they really are very tiny house friendly in remote areas especially. However, you mentioned Oregon's desire to keep the sprawl. Mm-hmm. So most places in Oregon, you're not allowed to have an accessory dwelling unit in outside of the city, like in the rural areas. They're not allowed, even though there's great space there, there's a lot of room for them. They want to keep the density down in the rural areas and keep that density into the cities.
That's weird, because you can have a barn, a tool shed,
right?
Out on a farm, right?
Yeah, but you don't live in those, so you're not adding people and
houses. But what if you had a trailer and grandma and grandpa came to stay with you? Wouldn't that be the same?
Technically, that is not a permitted use. You would...
They can't live right in your driveway for, you know, a little while.
You can, just until somebody complains.
Oh. Right? Exactly. Ding, ding, ding. We have a winner.
Enforcement by complaint.
Did you learn that firsthand, Brent?
And it is, no. And it's, you know, it's an ongoing and historical conversation and conflict in Oregon land use laws is we own agricultural land or forested land, and you might be able to put a home on it, but you can't put a second home for the next generation. You can't sell part of it to, you know, your sons and daughters and build another home. So where can you build another home? And when does this cross
something
from
wrong
being
with that?
There is.
Yes.
There is. And having some options in regulation and allowable and land use laws is important.
Hmm.
You know, and I'll talk about low impact. You would think that this would be something that they would encourage, right?
Right. A tiny house is a very low impact. I mean, they have very low carbon footprint overall. And they're generally low occupancy. You know, mm-hmm. it's not going to be a family of 10 living in that living in that house.
So Renee, how did you go down this path? What led you down this path?
Well, I have moved a few times in my life. quite a few, and a couple of times to an island in Alaska and back. And that really showed me when I moved and had to really consider what is it that I have that's valuable enough to pay that shipping cost? You know, it's not cheap to move to an island. So that helped me downsize a lot, because I did have a 3,300 square foot, you know, 5-bedroom, 4-bath house, which I can now fit 87 of my little tiny houses in, you know. So I've been on both ends of that spectrum, sold that now. But just having that mobility and really loving architecture and historic architecture. A lot of the classic tiny houses we see are patterned after like a bungalow or a traditional historic home. And they just have a lot of that charm that that draws me. So it seemed to be a good fit, you know, plus I'm an empty nester now. And so it's just me and the things that I consider valuable, and I can, you know, travel to where my kids are.
Where your loved ones are. Yeah. All right, real quick before we run out of time, you have a symposium coming up that has to do with the regulations and educating some of the policymakers.
Right, and helping them, answering their questions, finding out really, you know, one-on-one, or close, not one-on-one, but in a small group, what's the issues that they're running up against, and how can we help them with that? How can we provide information that perhaps we in the tiny house industry have? And so this is for city, county, state officials, you know, folks in building code, land use, zoning, planning, and other organizations such as United Way, which is working to build a tiny house community here in Salem.
Right. Yeah, yes. we talked about
that. We did talk about that, yeah.
Right. And there's a Habitat for Humanity organization on the coast that's coming in, because they're really looking at that as an option as well. And so I think there's another Habitat community being, you know, looked into south of Portland, so between here and Portland. So folks like that will be there to really get some questions answered.
Well, your subject matter is really broad. I mean, when you think about it, now we're talking about using tiny houses, tiny living, as basic humanitarian housing. And you also have some very high-end ones. You also have some really nice homes, just minimal space, right? So you're not taking up a lot of space in the universe, and you're not cluttering down your lives, and you have more, presumably, money and time and freedom to go live the life you want, right?
Yes, to all of that, exactly.
That's a broad that is a broad subject. And we're also talking about some things that are mobile, some things that are planted on land, some things are planted on land you own and you don't own.
Right. And a lot of folks are looking at these as an income-generating property, as maybe an Airbnb type of offering that they can put in their yard. There are a couple of tiny house hotels in Portland, and the owner of one of those is coming down to talk about tiny houses as a short-term rental. It's a very popular income-producing property that's not quite as permanent. You know, if it if you decide after 4 or 5 years it's really not working out the way you wanted, or sometimes people decide to move into the tiny one and rent out the big one. That's a common thing.
Wow.
Yeah,
so
I could see that.
There's flexibility there with the tiny houses that, you know.
Sure.
A lot of them don't move every day down the road. You're not seeing them, you know, being used as a camper as often as, you know, you might see on television. But they are able to move. They move with you as you, maybe you move for a new job or to be near a loved one. You know, if I need to go take care of my parents someday, I can just take my home with me and park it right there in there next to their place.
Hopefully you don't run into regulations on that.
Yeah.
Not where we live in Iowa.
No, okay.
Oh. So let's talk about that, because we've already established your home goes with you.
Yes.
Do you have a hard time finding services for it? Because obviously there's basic needs of housing with running water and sewage and things like that.
And
power.
Yeah.
Correct.
So is that always, you're looking for a mobile home park, for an RV park kind of thing?
Well, most people would, yes, especially the homes that are, you know, a little bit bigger. A lot of tiny houses are built with solar. Many of them are off-grid capable, especially the school buses and the vans that have a tendency to travel more, and the small tiny houses like mine that have a tendency to travel more. So I don't really need to plug in. I fill up a water tank under my bed about once every 3 or 4 weeks. So as long as I have access to water at that time. A lot of people have composting toilets, and there's a big move out there to separate the gray water and the black water, which is allowable here in Oregon. In some states, gray water and black water are all considered the same. And so, you know, the rules are different everywhere. And so even just water regulation is something you have to learn about when you travel around.
There's always a need for this educational component in just about every subject matter of life, you know, because even keeping track of those and the regulations and how they differ for your shows in California and from the Midwest and Oregon, they're all going to have different jurisdictions and not a lot of uniformity, I imagine.
And different needs for the tiny houses. Like you said, there are so many different options for them. In the Midwest, we don't have that housing crisis that we have here, and it's very extreme in San Diego. So the desire for a tiny home might be driven for different reasons in different areas.
Sure. If I have a soybean farm in Iowa, can I plop a tiny home on it next to my house?
It really depends.
I mean, Oregon, we're establishing probably not, but in Iowa?
Right. And so these regulations are most often determined by the city or the county. Hmm. And they're not as often statewide regulations as Oregon has, which has been very nice that they've, you know, developed the REACH code and, you know, then this year refined it a bit. So there it's kind of county by county. That's challenging when you have a house that moves. You know,
sure.
You're fine in one spot, but not in another. And so, yeah, it's nice to have that uniformity to...
All right. Right now, we've got a listener who is an empty nester who finds this interesting. It's going to come to Tiny Fest Northwest. We've got a listener who has in-laws or parents that might need to come live with them, and they're going to find the subject matter interesting, or people whose kids need to live on the property and so forth. Very interesting. Thank you for joining us. This has been Renee McLaughlin. She's the CEO of Tiny Fest. And you want to check out Tiny Fest Northwest. Give us a website.
TinyFestNorthwest.com.
TinyFestNorthwest.com to check it out for August 17th and 18th. We got to take a quick break. We're running behind, but we'll be right back here on Newsmakers with Brent and Dave. 1430 KYKN Salem is listening.
Lynn Benton Tractor's Newsmakers, presented by Les Schwab Tires, continues in the Capital Auto Group studios. Here's Brent DeHart and Dave Bourne on 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.
This segment of Newsmakers is proudly brought to you by Sylvan Learning Center.
Welcome.
Yeah,
go on. Just start talking, Brent.
Just start talking,
Brent.
It's not your first day. Yeah, you act like it's your first day.
Hey, welcome back to Newsmakers. This is Brent DeHart. I am here with Dave Bourne. We went from one interesting subject matter with the Tiny Living Festival, Tiny Fest Northwest. Now we're going to talk about warbirds over the West. We talked a little bit about it last week for just a few minutes, and we had to come back and hit this because it's fun. Because
yes.
It's Salem, it's the airport, and it's a bit of history. It's something different. We don't see it all the time. And you know what? What's happening in Salem with the restoration of the B-17 bomber is unprecedented, really, in our region. It's amazing. So we welcome back to the studio. We've had her on 6 months ago or so, Terry Scott of the B-17 Alliance. Welcome.
Thank you.
It's nice
glad to
have
be
you
here.
Back.
Yeah.
So your husband sent you this time. He was here last week.
Yes.
And he sent you this time because he's busy.
He got called to duty. Big time.
He's busy flipping a wing, you said.
Yeah, flipping a wing. They have constructed a rotisserie, you might say. I had one of the docents explain it that way on a tour the other day, and I thought, oh, that's a good way to talk about it. It's like a rotisserie in your barbecue, except for it's a wing of a B-17, and they've been constructing this since last October. Engineering is pretty in depth. It's pretty an amazing. This is a big piece of the aircraft, and they do not want to drop it.
Yay.
And so they've got the forklift, and my husband is Jason, is running the forklift, making sure that everything is safe.
Wow. And Dan, you invented this thing? You had to like manufacture it for this restoration purpose?
Yes, exactly.
Is that a technology that can be used in other restoration efforts?
You know, I'm not really sure. Every restoration is kind of unique. And, you know, they're not making the items that would restore that aircraft anymore. So a lot of what we do has to be recreated.
Wow.
Yeah. That's why it takes so long.
Wow.
Yeah.
Holy
mm-hmm.
cow. Mm-hmm. So if you've never seen a B-17, folks, they are not small.
No. Yeah. No, you were talking tiny. We're big. You got everything in Salem. Tiny and big.
That wig is larger than our previous guest's house. Right?
By about three times.
Yeah. They're huge.
Yeah.
So it's very exciting, and this is a good opportunity. People haven't come out to see the museum, haven't come out and toured the restoration effort. This weekend, you have all of these other aircraft coming out. You can walk on the blacktop, right? out on the ramp and see all those aircraft, but also see the progress of the B-17, right?
Yes, that's really, we want you to come and enjoy all the living history that we're having to offer between airplanes and military vehicles. The Vietnam Veteran Wall will be there from Roseburg. It's a lot of honoring veterans, too. Mm-hmm. We love veterans. You know, it's really part of who we are. And then while you're intaking in all that, come and see the museum. We got great tour guides. They are trained to tell you stories. And then also the restoration. You will see it firsthand. Look inside the engines, everything of a B-17. See the engineering. Did you know that bridge designers engineered the B-17?
No. What?
Yeah. So if you look at the wing of a B-17, it looks like a bridge. And then that is why I believe that they were called the Flying Fortress. Because, you know, they came home time and time again with their crew, yeah, safe and sound. Mm. And that is why the crews loved them so much. They didn't fall apart. They could be blown up halfway and still land and save everybody.
So the museum, it's actually in the hangar where the restoration effort's taking place. And so you get to walk through. And you've got donations and stories. And from it's pretty cool. It's not a huge museum by any means, but it really sets the flavor and the tone. And it gives you a background about the aircraft. And before you take a look at this thing.
Yeah. Our goal is to build a World War II education center. So a World War II Memorial Education Center. So we've been collecting the stories of the veterans for a long time. And those are the stories we tell. The veterans, the Rosie the Riveters, the home front. I love to do stuff for student tours on ration tickets and victory gardens and all the things that were good about that era as well.
All right. We're talking to Terry Scott of the B-17 Alliance. Event is this weekend. So let's talk about that really quick. Hours?
Hours, 9 to 4, Saturday and Sunday, all day.
9 to 4, Saturday and Sunday, all day. Will there be food and drink out there?
Food, drink. Sandy Ann Brewery will be there.
Oh, wow.
And so there'll be some...
10 more people just signed up.
Yeah,
just
baby.
After saying that.
Some really good beer.
Brent's eyes lit up.
Uh-huh.
Saturday and Brewery.
Lots of things. The admission's $15, and we also have a discounted family price, $5 off for veterans. And so just come, enjoy it. We've been working a long time to put this together for you, so you can be entertained.
And here's the thing about the entry. It goes to restoration of the aircraft, right?
Yes.
This is a fundraiser. So don't back away from this because there's an entry fee. The entry fee is your contribution to bringing this B-17 to life.
Thank you.
Right?
Yes.
Just go, hey, here's my donation. Call a day. Write it off if you like, but consult your CPA. Yep.
We have one in the back
but
room.
Come out and... come on, write a check. And, you know, it could be more than $15 a person if
it
you need
could
to.
Be,
yeah. It's going to take a lot of money, and this thing is pretty darn cool. All right, B-17 Alliance. We want to tell the story a little bit. I'll wait for after the break because it's been a while. It's been over 6 months since we had you on. We'll do the abbreviated version.
Oh, yes.
But I want to make sure people are coming out this weekend. What kind of aircraft are they going to see? Some old ones and some ones that you don't normally get to see at an air show or even at a World War II or even an aircraft museum.
Yeah, you talked a lot about the PBY last week. Mm-hmm. The Wildcat from Erickson's coming, the N3N, the Texas, the T6 Texan.
Yeah.
And we have about 26 confirmed aircraft coming.
Wow. I
wonder how many pilots learn to fly, how many military pilots learn to fly in a Texan.
Oh, yeah.
There you go,
the
right?
The T6, the trainer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Wow. That is so cool.
I know about that one.
You know about that.
I do.
All right. Hey, this is Terry Scott with us here on Newsmaker. She's executive director, I believe, of the B-17 Alliance. We're talking about Warbirds Over the West happening at McNary Field. If you've never visited the airport, I want you to come out. It's cool down there, folks. You can get a tour. Salem Airport is actually pretty substantial. You get to see all these warbirds. You get to see a restoration process in process of an incredible plane right here in Salem. Stick with us. We're going to be right back. You're listening to Newsmakers with Brent and Dave on 1430 KYKN.
This is Lynn Benton Tractor's Newsmakers with Brent and Dave, presented by Les Schwab Tires and sponsored in part by Furbish, a salvage place, and Kennedy Tax Solutions. Now, let's go back to the Capital Auto Group studios on 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.
This segment of Newsmakers proudly brought to you by Green Acres Landscape.
Welcome back, folks. This is Brent DeHart. We're talking about Warbirds Over the West. I've been neglectful. I got to tell you guys, it's more than just the aircraft out there. They've got, of course, the historic aircraft, living history encampment. They have vehicles out there. You said there's going to be a half track that people get a ride in.
Yeah, half track that people can get a ride in around the airport.
And there'll be some helicopters. The National Guard helicopter will have a display. The Coast Guard helicopter will have a display. And something, this is new to me, so I may have to go check it out, the Rat Rods.
Mm-hmm.
Gary Fisher's and his friends
are Gary Fisher's award-winning Rat Rods. Yes, they are pieces of art. They're work of art made into cars. So they're cars that have, they're made out of junk, I think. I'm not sure, but it's pretty junk.
And, of course, food and drink and going through the museum and the restoration hangar and all sorts of things. If you want your kids to have a sense of history. So I don't care if they're 5 or they're 25, bring them out. Bring them out and have them learn something about
make a memory.
What it was like back then and how many. I mean, I know for my kids are military buffs and they're history buffs overall. And just the concept that these things are their grandfather's generation. Yes. And how far we have come. Now we're talking about SpaceX, right? Now we're talking about Mars trips. And while we were fighting for humanity on the planet in World War II, this was the technology.
Yeah.
This was.
And, and people who are alive today, this is their reality. This was their reality. And just make sure people get the historical context.
Well, that's kind of what B-17 Alliance wants to do, is we want to change, you know, never forget what happened in World War II for us to live in a free country. There's so many cultural differences in the way we lived life. That's why they were the greatest generation. You know, mm-hmm. they really worked hard to get where we are today. And we don't want to forget what they did. So when you come out to Warbirds Over the West, take the opportunity to teach and educate from this living history. How is it different? And why did they use it? And all the sacrifices that were made when they used it.
Yeah. Mm. And the B-17, it's so rare. I mean, we take it for granted, and sometimes you can go to an air show or an air museum and see them. But we're talking about right here in Salem, McNary Field, 25th and Mission.
Right.
Them restoring this thing to flyable state.
Yes, this will fly in honor of a great generation.
Wow. I mean, that's amazing. All right. Well, I asked you this before, but I've forgotten. Timeline. When are we going to see this thing fly? 5 years from now? 10 years from now? 2 years from now? Or does it all depend on donations?
It depends on a lot of variables. And right now we're getting into it deeper than we've ever been. We are really excited about the work that's being done. We have probably 6 sections at minimum being worked on right now.
Wow.
So it's about volunteerism. It's about donations. And it's about time, because time, it does take a lot of time to restore B-17. So we're still looking, we keep saying 10 years, but that's because we keep starting, right? We're really getting our feet on the ground now, and we're really excited about it. And so things really are starting to rock and roll. $6 million is the estimated amount of money, but we have so many in-kind donations. I'm also starting to work on a capital campaign, because when you come to our hangar, you'll see that it is not big enough.
Mm. Yeah.
And we need to grow. Right. And our volunteers are excited, and they ask me all the time, let me get in that new building. And I'm working on it. We're one step at a time.
Well, somewhere out there, there's a listener who's a World War II vet that has, he's just got that extra life insurance policy. He doesn't know who to leave that to. So, of course, you have a foundation, and you're a nonprofit, right?
Yes.
So,
501c3.
So, folks, if you want to be a part of that, you absolutely can. This is a very cool thing. I encourage you all to go out. And you said take an opportunity to learn. But speak to the people like your docents that are out there that have the stories.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the people will tell you the stories and you get to learn.
Make sure you come to the museum and meet our volunteers. They are excited to share.
Are there any opportunities to get up in the air, Terry?
There's a few. Not necessarily directly related to our event, but the PBY will be selling tickets all day Friday, $350. And then again, Saturday night after our event closes, they will be doing tickets, $350 again in the PBY. And then also there may be an opportunity for veterans to get in on a drawing.
Oh, it just may be an opportunity for veterans. What about active service people?
Oh, that too.
Yes. Okay. Uh-huh. So if you're not an aviation buff and you're like, what the heck is a PBY? Is that a sandwich?
It sounded like one.
It did.
It does.
A PBY Catalina, that is an aircraft. It's
really cool.
It lands on water. It's designed to land on water. It's got engines up above on top of the wing there. And they used them for so many purposes. And they were popular in the Northwest, of course. But they would search for subs is how I think of them. But they do observation and all sorts of different kinds of missions. And they don't get a lot of press. Right.
There's not very many in the world. I can't tell you how many there is.
Told us last week, Terry.
Okay.
That there's only 2 that are flying.
Oh, wow.
Is that right? Is that what he said?
I think that's what he said.
I'll have to go back to the table.
Okay.
We'll just call it that until I'm proven wrong.
Okay. So the Ericsson Aircraft has one in their museum.
Yes.
And we were down there with our son, who's 19, about a year ago, and he got an opportunity to get in any of the aircraft that they had, and he chose the PBY.
Huh.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. Cool. You have a Stearman out there.
Yes,
so that's
we will.
Biplane.
Biplane.
Mm-hmm. Those are awesome. And those are big ones.
People, you have honor flights for the Stearman?
The honor flights are also another segment that are not directly related to our event, but they're people that we collaborate with and try to help one another. They do dream flights for veterans. So we're really honored to have two of our veteran volunteers be able to participate in their flights on this weekend.
That sounds like a really, really good event. How's the city been in terms of working with the airport and getting permission to hold a big event and so forth?
They've been awesome. They really are helping a lot. They're actually providing a directional sign for us to help people find where to park, because that's a big deal.
Yeah.
We need a lot of signs to get people to this event.
And where are they going to park? Are they going to park by the terminal?
They are parking by the terminal, yes. And there'll be nice signage to get you there.
All right, folks. I hate to tell you this, but I know somebody who lived in Salem for like 9 or 10 years, and they didn't know how to get to the airport. It's on 25th Street. South of Mission. So you come down past where the Kmart was, and it's going to be on your left. And there's a terminal area. There's a general aviation area where the flight deck restaurant is. If you've never
been
to the
flight. That's too far. If you go to the flight deck, you've gone too far.
Can they park there?
No. They have to park in our parking.
Oh,
the flight deck wants to keep their parking for their customers.
Okay. Well, if you've never been to the flight deck, you can come by and have some lunch there
restaurant.
As well and watch the planes come and go. But prior to that, there is a terminal out there, folks, where our future commercial flights will come in and out of.
Plug, watch for the signs to
park there and come out and see the airplanes. All right, let's just talk about your aircraft, the
our
Foundation's
aircraft. This is the lowest time B-17 in the world. Okay, so the lowest flight time of any B-17 in the world. Now, not being an aviation buff or a history buff, and I'm the managing the museum, why am I doing this? Because I love veterans and I love the stories that the plane tells. Mm. But as we were restoring the plane, I started seeing why that was so important. There's brand new parts in the plane. The engines are like brand new inside. Mm-hmm. It is pretty phenomenal.
So why do you have to restore the whole thing if there's only 39 hours or whatever on the plane?
Because it sat out in the weather, in Oregon's weather, for 70 years. Nearly 70
That's
years.
That's true, it did.
Yes. Yeah. So that weather, you know how Oregon is. It rains a lot. And so we have a lot of corrosion. So they're working on that. About a third of the fuselage will have to be replaced because of corrosion. But regardless, the entire aircraft will be rebuilt to flight worthy.
So if you're not familiar with the story, this served as the canopy for a gas station.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. For many, many years, so the purchaser brought it back to Oregon and lofted it up above, and it was the canopy as an attraction above a gas station.
Yeah.
And sat there for a long time. They said, we can't let this go to waste.
No.
Fast forward to here, and here we are.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
I actually got gas at that gas station when the B-17 was up there. That was pretty cool.
My mom bought gas there when she was pregnant with me, so I was destined to be part of the family.
I see.
Wow.
And you married into the family.
I married into the family.
Okay. So the first time I saw that nose cone, folks, it was breathtaking. First time I saw, hey, there's the first piece, and the whole plane's going to look like. That's exactly what I said. The whole plane's going to look like this. And it took my breath away. So come on out to Warbirds Over the West, Salem Airport this weekend, 9 to 4 Saturday, 9 to 4 Sunday. Bring the kids, bring your checkbook, and have a good time. That's it for Newsmakers. With Brent and Dave, we'll see you again tomorrow or Thursday. Thanks for joining us.
I'll see you tomorrow.
This has been Lynn Benton Tractor's Newsmakers with Brent DeHart and Dave Bourne. Presented by Les Schwab Tires and sponsored in part by Furbish, a salvage place, and Kennedy Tax Solutions. Live local talk that matters to you from the Capital Auto Group studios exclusively on 1430 KYKN. Salem is listening.